Cinnamon tea.
Black, the closest thing to coffee.
Not even that. See, that's your problem. You're thinking about tea that needs to be close to coffee. You need to think about tea as its own thing. Otherwise, you're always going to be disappointed.
I will never, ever do that.
There are more people in the world that consume tea than coffee.
Do you like tea more, cool people? More than coffee?
Or? No, I like coffee okay. more than tea. More cool people. But I like tea occasionally. And I don't like not being able to fall asleep because I've had coffee in the afternoon.
Yeah.
That's the worst.
Pretty what bad. About coffee in the evening and not being able to sleep at all? Bad move?
Weren't you just complaining about not getting enough sleep?
Yeah.
How do you make your coffee?
French press every morning.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you grind your beans?
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Not by hand.
We're going to have to.
And not with a burr grinder. We have an electric grinder, not a burr grinder. So we're not that hipster.
Oh, I use a burr grinder.
Nice.
Yeah. Chemex.
I assume it makes a difference. That's what I've been told.
Yeah. Couldn't tell you if it does.
I definitely think grinding it just before you brew it makes a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I can tell.
Yeah.
I hate you both right now.
Although the pour over I had at Sam's. Come on, Sam. We had pour over at your
true.
House.
That's true. I'm just kidding.
At your apartment.
Yeah, Chemex is nice.
Yeah. There's AeroPress.
AeroPress, I've heard, is amazing.
I've heard it's good. I have some friends who like that.
What is
it? It's almost like an upside down French press. That's what it looks like. It's like sits on top of your mug and it's, I don't know, you like push it down. I don't know.
Yeah. Hmm. Pressure.
The water, the grounds are in with the water and you're like squeezing it out.
Yeah. I was at the Starbucks Reserve Roastery. They have one here in Chelsea. And I haven't been to it yet, but we went in Seattle and they have this thing called a siphon. It's pretty cool. It looks like a science experiment. And it's like a glass bowl.
I had one of those one time.
And it like pulls the water boils up and it comes through. You mix the coffee in and then you turn it off and the suction pulls it back down. And it leaves like a perfect like bulbous mound of coffee at the top, which means like it's everything has been equally soaked, you know, and nothing's been over extracted. And then like the suction pulls it back down and it was pretty delicious. It was like very clean tasting coffee.
Nice. Did they make it in front of you? Like yeah. Was it made to order?
You get like a coffee flight.
Wow.
So you chew like three coffees and then you're like sitting there like, I'm ready for my third one.
How much money is that experience?
It was like $35, mm-hmm. But it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. And then they had like all these fun pastries. I was actually very impressed. A Starbucks Reserve Roaster is something you would think might be a little kitschy or,
like a Budweiser.
Yeah.
Budweiser Reserve.
I do not understand that. They have this whole ad campaign that's based on, you know, the everyman. Like we don't care about our list of ingredients. We don't, you know, it's for the many, not the few. And then they have Reserve.
Yeah.
Budweiser Reserve. I don't get it.
Oh, it's supposed to be like the champagne version or something.
Yeah.
They're
the same antithetical.
They're advertising one now. It's like based on the moon landing and they're describing all their like, it's like hint of toffee and this. I'm like, but it's Budweiser.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely recommend that. There's like six of them around the world. Starbucks Reserve Roastery. Sound like it's like sponsor of this podcast. it is good though. It is good.
Call to action. Anyone's connected with Starbucks Reserve, one's able to get us a podcast sponsor.
Cool. So you're visiting New York City, man. What you up here for?
Hey, I'm Nathan. I'm your brother. Now everyone gets to play the game of who's who if they're listening. Because people tell us we sound similar on the phone, at least.
That's true. People have actually told us we look similar, too.
Yeah.
As we've gotten into our elder years. When I was 6 and you were 12, no one made that mistake.
That's right.
But people have said we were twins before. There's sometimes we look more alike than others.
Right.
Actually, now I have longer hair than you, which is basically never happened in the last 20 years.
Yeah. It's so unusual. So I'm up here in New York for a couple of days, came up to represent my startup called Omnimodal, and check out this, program we applied to. That's like an urban tech cities, government focused accelerator.
Nice.
Yeah.
And Omnimodal is an Ember app.
Omnimodal is many apps.
Many apps. We'll get into that.
big, thick layer of pancake stack technology. Yeah.
Would DHH approve of your technology stack?
Maybe. there are some compromises. Anyway, yes, we have a number of Ember apps, and the main kind of user-facing, customer-facing apps are Ember apps backed by Rails with JSON API.
Nice. And by we, you mean you and your team of five other full-time engineers, right?
How I wish. How I wish. Yeah, so I'm pretty much doing 95% of it. Occasionally, I'll get some help from folks like our friend Olivier has helped me out with some stuff on the Rails end. But yeah, I do most of it. So that includes the Ember Rails app, a legacy Java app that is part of our infrastructure that is basically a prediction engine.
You inherited that.
Yes. Well, I chose it, but it existed before I got started, and it solves a key problem that is part of our technology.
It's not something you built from scratch.
Correct.
Right.
And then some random node apps and AWS infrastructure. So some of it's running on Heroku, some of it's on AWS, and then a sprinkling of PubNub, which is this data streaming network, which is kind of interesting.
Funny name.
Yeah.
It's hard to say it without laughing.
PubNub.
Is it a like third-party service, or is it something you run yourself?
It's a third-party service. Okay. So it's almost like Heroku to EC2 is PubNub to cobbling that together yourself on Amazon.
I see. Cool.
Yeah. So, basically, just to step back for a sec, startup works with cities and other municipalities to bring together mobility data from a variety of different sources, including real-time public transit data, emerging forms of mobility like bike share, scooter share, real-time smart parking capacity, road closures, traffic, basically anything that affects the transportation infrastructure in a city. We collect all that data into an analytics dashboard so that city staff can monitor it, analyze it, and forecast it to help manage the transportation demand.
Cool. What is real-time parking?
Real-time parking. So have you ever seen like a smart meter on street parking?
Yes.
So a lot of times those, you know, will have sensors that can determine whether there's a car parked there or not.
Like the arrow, like it's a green or red arrow above a parking spot.
That as well. Yeah. So if you've ever been in a garage that has those indicators per spot, you essentially have real-time capacity to know if the garage is full or not. So between garages and service lots and smart parking, more and more parking infrastructure is getting put online, which can help. If you think about this from like a commuter perspective,
into a garage and look.
Yeah. I mean, as you're traveling from point A to point B, you're using a variety of different means of mobility. And if driving is part of that, if parking is part of that, a big way to reduce congestion is make sure people don't circle around looking for parking for a long time. And to make sure that they get routed in whatever trip planning engines, whether that's Google Maps or something else that's directing them, get routed to a spot where they're going to be able to park instead of having to look.
That's super cool.
I
would drive more into the city,
right,
if I had that.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it was predictable. Yeah. Driving around looking for a parking spot is like a huge deterrent.
Yeah. So everyone, as they go around, like, and think about how they're going to move around, get to work, get to school, get to the doctor, is thinking about convenience. They're thinking about affordability and access, and depending on their needs, you know, make different choices about whether they drive or whether they take public transit. And for a lot of folks, you know, they're forced into a situation that's not ideal for them. And we actually got started as a social enterprise because one of the key indicators of somebody's ability to escape poverty is how long their commute is. So if you have an above average commute, you know, it just eats into your time. And if that commute is unsafe or dangerous or inconvenient, or, you know, it's not a situation that lets you do anything during that time, it's even more of a waste of time. And it just kind of eats into your ability to make your life better. So it's like a societal issue. It's an environmental issue. When you talk about CO2 emissions, a large proportion of that comes from transportation. So cities are trying to figure out how to get more people out of solo vehicles and into other situations that are more sustainable.
Interesting. Have there been any like stories of how you've been able to like cut down the time, or just systems in general have been able to cut down the time, like the commute time?
Ryan wants to know because he moved to New Jersey and started sliding into poverty when his commute went to an hour and a half.
Well, yeah, Ryan, I asked you about your commute earlier today because I was curious about it. So you said you take the ferry.
Yeah,
but how do you get to the ferry?
I walk. There's a shuttle, but okay. I walk. It's like a good 20-minute clear your mind walk.
Yeah, nice.
So he likes to tell himself. This is such a benefit to my day. I get to clear my mind for 40 minutes every day. It's an incredible gift.
Throw in a podcast.
Yeah, a little bit of learning, a little bit of exercise. Yep. That's cool. Yeah.
20 minutes to the ferry.
20 minutes to the ferry.
How long does the ferry take?
Ferry from New Jersey to New York is about 8 minutes.
That's pretty good.
It's the fastest part of the commute.
Nice. And then from on the New York side to our the lovely office. WeWork.
So there's a shuttle that I'll take like in the winter because it's cold, or if I'm lazy, because I'm lazy. or I'll walk. Like this morning I walked and it's probably like 20-minute walk.
Gotcha. So. And do you have any kind of real-time information about the ferry? Like if it's running late, do you know?
So the ferry is almost always on time. Okay. Like seriously, if it's
very predictable.
Yeah, super predictable. The shuttles, they have an app that shows like when the shuttles are coming, but you can the app's never accurate. Okay. And also too, those are pretty predictable. So you just realize like they basically leave when the ferry comes into the station. The shuttles leave, so you look.
So they're aligned. They're aligned with the ferry schedule. Yes,
exactly.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So you can kind of time everything like that.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of times, like I live in Orlando, and you know, some of the different parts of the transportation infrastructure are aligned like that intentionally, and some of them are definitely not. So part of what we do is when we work with clients, whether they're a city or a mobility provider. We talk about all these things and kind of how the pieces of the puzzle get fit together. And if the schedule is not aligned, or if they're not sharing the schedule in data formats that are accessible to the apps that everyone normally uses, like Google Maps, mm-hmm. Apple Maps, and Transit app and things like that, then we advise them and help create that data. And then we also consume the data that they create into the system as well.
Cool. What about like, so I started taking the ferry because I used to take the bus.
Okay.
And the bus was unpredictable just because of like accidents, like going through the tunnel, there'd be an accident and all of a sudden it's like.
Yeah, subject to traffic if they don't have dedicated lanes.
Yeah. So like, is there anything like, how can they solve that? Like things that are like out of their control like that.
Yeah.
Like, what could they do?
Yeah. I mean, buses are critical in this country for sure because we don't have like an expansive rail network. And in terms of public transit, like mass transit, they're really critical, but you do have to do some things to make them work well. And dedicated lanes is one of those things, you know, even if it's not the entire route, having certain parts of the road where the bus can pass traffic and be prioritized is really important. Traffic signal priority is another way they do that. So bus is able to kind of jump through lights before the rest of the traffic. So there need to be things like that. In the infrastructure and in the policies that kind of prioritize the mass transit. And then in terms of the predictability, that's where we got started. So we got started because we knew that riding the bus could be very unpredictable and difficult if you don't know when it's coming. And in a city like Orlando, some of the routes only run once an hour. So if you don't have up-to-date information and you miss the bus, you could be spending an extra hour waiting in the sun, in the rain, you know, late to work, all those types of things. So making sure that all of the vehicles are tracked and that they're feeding into essentially a prediction engine that gives accurate predictions on when they're going to arrive and when they're going to get you where you want to go is really important.
Cool. Very cool.
One thing I've always liked about the work y'all are doing is like it's a realistic incremental improvement approach, as opposed to trying to reinvent everything, you know, and give everyone like jetpacks to get to work.
Yes.
It's like, no, we have buses. We have bad buses. We have bad subways. We have bad whatever. How can we improve it, you know?
Yes. I mean, we really like, we are grounded in the reality of what it's like to use public transit and depend on it. I mean,
The crappy reality.
Yes. Like the very, a very real reality.
Right.
Like David rode the bus. My co-founder, David, who's our CEO, rode the bus exclusively in Orlando for 4 years. Amy and I, my wife, were like a one car household. And you know, having
a place for people who don't live in a place like Orlando,
yes,
that's a big deal.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. So, I mean, we're in New York. New York is a city unto itself,
right?
You know, in terms of density in our country, but most cities in the U.S. are sprawling, suburban,
right?
Have not grown up with the type of density that was forced in New York because of the geography and because of, you know, the history of it,
right?
So yeah, everything's spread out and it can be really hard to get around without a car,
right?
But yeah, it's like we've got problems now. I know how to program and I understand technology and the impact that it can have. I want to solve some problems now that are impacting people now.
Yeah.
That's like why I wanted to start a business and why I wanted to start a business that was more than kind of the consulting work that I was doing.
Yeah.
It's like, I want to impact people's lives in a bigger way using the skills and expertise that I've, you know, developed over the last 15 years of doing freelance programming and design.
Yep. Yep. Very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can you ingest all this traffic, bus, you know, transportation data. How does that end up in the like the bus rider's hands?
Yeah. So there's a lot of moving parts, but basically what we try to do is work with open data formats that have been adopted by the industry and that are compatible with different trip planning apps, commuter facing apps and systems. So the bus rider is a good example because about a little over 10 years ago, Google and TriMet, which is the transit authority in Portland, Oregon, got together to try and figure out how do we take the schedule of the bus and put that into a simple data format that any transit agency can create that will be something that's compatible and consistent across all transit authorities. How do we break out the PDF, the schedule that's in the PDF, you know, into an actual data format? What they landed on was a collection, essentially a collection of CSV files that represented a relational database. So you can literally encode the schedule of a bus system by hand just by creating CSV files or using Excel or something like that. Mm-hmm. You have to be careful and make sure that the IDs match and everything like that. But they made it simple enough that, you know, people could do it without a lot of technical expertise. Over time, they added on to that. And that data format, by the way, is called the General Transit Feed Specification, or GTFS. So over time, they built on top of that.
It's nice that you're starting out with that, something that was thought through like that.
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah,
it'd be completely different. Game.
Definitely.
If it was just unstructured PDFs.
Yeah, definitely. But the unstructured PDF, I'll come back to in a second. But so building on top of that in the last 5 years or so has been, the focus has been on real time. So now that we have, you know, cellular technology and GPS sensors that are very accessible, how do we take the information about where the vehicles are and incorporate that into a different layer on top of the schedule? So if the bus produces that data in those formats, then they can plug into Google Maps, they can plug into Apple Maps, they can plug into Transit App, and anyone that has designed an app to ingest that data. So that's the approach we try to take with every kind of vertical of data. Is there an existing open data standard or an emerging open data standard that we can utilize, because that's going to be the most scalable type solution. Now, parking is an area where there's been less structure. Consolidation and structure. So I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for us as we work with cities that where parking is a key component of this. You know, what does it look like to create a general parking feed specification and bring that into the same kind of realm where we get all of that stuff online and developers can easily work with it because libraries spring up around it to work with it. You know, so like with the GTFS data right now, you know, with the real time and the static, there are a whole bunch of libraries that you can just use in any language you're working with to start working with that data if you want. So that's kind of where the approach that we try to take.
Cool.
So, you know, when I got started programming, I was choosing PHP frameworks because that was your background.
Yeah.
Symfony at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I eventually got into Ember. You know, you've done a lot of consulting over the years. You've done graphics stuff. You had some Ember experience. You've done a lot of PHP development. It sounds like, well, instead of putting words in your mouth, like, what were the things that led you to choose kind of the tech stack that you chose?
Mm-hmm.
And how does Ember and the other technologies that are in that stack help solve the problems that you knew you wanted to go in and tackle?
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, a PHP app or something else that you also had experience with, because basically you're like a polyglot when it comes to this stuff. Like you have dabbled in many things,
yep,
and have the ability to learn quickly. And so you basically had a big choice. So kind of, I'm interested in the Ember stuff, but also like the SPA architecture and kind of services, mm-hmm, as opposed to like the more, I guess, monolithic approach.
Yep. Yep, for sure. So I did like a ton of C++ coding and real-time graphic stuff. Like that's kind of what I studied and what I was into for a long time was, like OpenGL and C++. So pretty low level things. And I did a bunch of stuff, for, design firms that were doing these experiential, installations for big brands, where there would be like a big video wall and there would be a lot of performance necessary to kind of eke out of that.
Like, but like JavaScript performance?
Well, no, until more recently.
Yeah.
Right. So I actually, when I was still doing that work, I started bringing in Ember.
You can move the mic a little bit closer.
Okay.
Yeah. Just pull it.
I started bringing Ember into the picture. So I did a couple installations where I combined Ember, basically rendering into a web view that was part of a C++ and OpenGL app.
Did I ever show you this? It was super cool.
I think you might have.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Or you might have told me about it.
I was trying to get him to present at like EmberConf or something.
Yeah, I still might someday.
Yeah, that was really neat. But basically, like there was a lot of it that was pure HTML, pure DOM and JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had parts of it that were delegated like off to C++, yep, right? Because, yep, they were like the gestures. You were like, he was writing his own gestures, basically.
Yes.
Cool. What made you bring in Ember? Like, what did it unlock? Or yeah, HTML? And
so I've also created some of my own UI frameworks, basically from scratch, you know, as an exercise, but also to have complete creative control over the projects. And anyone who has ever tried to do that realizes
how much the platform is giving you.
Yeah, realizes how difficult it is and painful.
Layouts, buttons, toggles. Because you built a whole UI for a game, almost a game.
Yep. Exactly.
That was all C++?
That was all C++.
Wow.
And it was using a framework. It was using a framework called Cinder.
Yep.
But you know, there weren't that many pieces that were done for me. It was pretty low level.
Right.
Definitely much lower level than working with HTML and CSS and JavaScript. So when you start doing a bunch of UI programming, you quickly realize that you need something that's designed to create UIs. And more of the technology, even that game developers are using, is bringing in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript for UIs and kind of blending that into the game engine. Because it's a great starting point. It's just so much faster. So as long as you can kind of get what you need to get in terms of the styling and the animations and things like that within that context, then you can move a lot more quickly.
I have a dumb question, but when you say UIs, you mean like the buttons and the menus that you would find in a game?
Yeah. Yeah. So
because you have some background in game programming as well.
Yeah. I mean, basically all this interactive, you know, interactive experiential design stuff was essentially like game development,
right,
at a smaller scale.
Right.
But yeah, basically, you know, a game engine is kind of redrawing the screen all the time.
Yeah.
And the primitives that you're working with are like rectangles and triangles and points. It's not like, it's
buttons,
not like structured.
And
it's not layout.
Mm-hmm. Primitives.
Yeah. So you have, you know, a two-dimensional space or three-dimensional space, but like you got to kind of build it up from there. So even just the hierarchy, you know, the hierarchy of the UI, you have to kind of decide, you know, how you want to work with that stuff. So it becomes a pain in the butt, and it's like, let's bring in something that's designed for this kind of basic UI element and bring that in.
That's so interesting, right?
Yeah.
Well, also, like, how are game developers able to, on the one hand, do what seems to be like running circles around us in terms of what they're creating, mm-hmm. and what floor of the building they're starting on top of, and then on the other hand, having a hard time making like menus, you know? And I guess it's just the answer might just be the tool is special purposed for different things.
Yeah. I think, you know, the games are made by teams of a lot of people typically, and folks that work on kind of the core game engine might have a very different skill set than folks who are working on kind of the heads up display or the scan or something like that. And it's not like there aren't frameworks within game engines that focus on UI. You know, that stuff gets built up over time. But
right.
Part of it's like performance. It's like this has got to run at least 60 FPS on, you know, 4K television. Like, you can't afford necessarily to have the full overhead of other stuff. But we've gotten to the point now where you can like render, you can use a lot of the web tech and render that onto essentially flatten all that into a texture and get that texture into the game engine as part of the pipeline to improve the performance. Anyway,
that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Like for menus you're talking about still in the UI?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically
it would still make sense to do it in the other tool because it's faster to get the layout right and everything, but then you can like flatten it and just a post step that you optimize it or whatever, because you don't need all the flexibility at runtime or whatever.
Right. So like the project I was talking about basically used a bridge between Chromium, which is, you know, the engine that powers Google Chrome browser, and OpenGL. So whatever was rendered by Chromium, the browser's rendering engine. I mean, it, you know, inside of a browser, like it's got to take all of the DOM and everything else that describes what pixels to draw. And at some level, it's drawing pixels on the screen,
mm-hmm.
you know? So,
if you can get there
mm-hmm. or just like, it's almost like taking a snapshot of the whole thing mm-hmm. once it's been interpolated into pixels on the screen and then, you know, ingesting that into the space where everything is really fast and performant because it's using the GPU.
Right. This is some nerdy shit and I'm loving it. Do we have any whiskey around here?
So I have so many questions. So, so if someone like interacts with this,
yeah.
do you send those events like back
yes.
to Chromium and then like you're always kind of yes. like going so over this bridge back and forth?
Exactly. And some of that gets a little painful because it's, you know, it may not be done in a way that's like really seamless.
Are you like making this stuff up yourself? It's like, oh, when they interact over here, I should send a click event there.
There's kind of some basics. So it's like there was a bridge that I was using that, you know, would essentially allow you to send pass through clicks and drags and the things that you would be used, that the browser would be used to. But in some of the complication that I had was like, like scrolling, like what's the difference between in browser land? Yes, in browser land, imagine, you know, having to manually differentiate between a tap, a double tap, or a tap and drag.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of that kind of like gesture interpretation stuff has to be done manually if you're not fully within the browser space that has that well-defined API for those different events.
That makes sense.
And then also when you're interfacing with hardware, like touchscreen hardware or, you know,
multi-touch.
I've done also Geo. Things with Kinect and Leap Motion, which are gesture controllers.
They have a gyro.
They have infrared light that sees where your hand is or where your body is. And
this guy's on another level, man.
And then you have to decide what to do with that data, you know. So it's a different space where there's
you need less the lower definition. Level stuff, and you make yes. the trade off because the cost is you don't have the higher level button on click, do this thing.
Yeah.
There's just none of that. Because
yeah. You know, what's interesting to look at is IOKit, you know, Apple's
Where user they provide the gestures.
UI kit, rather. Mm-hmm. Yes, where they provide the gesture handling. Because if you actually look at their docs, you can kind of get a sense of the design decisions that have to be made around translating raw user input into well-defined gesture state engine. And, you know, basically it's a finite state machine where you've got, you know, I'm in the state of dragging. What
you're either dragging or you're tapping, and they have
and different actions, you know, propel you from one state to another, but there's this wiggle room in between where you could be one state or the other. There's you know, there's quite a bit that goes into just that gesture handling side of things.
I believe it. I mean, and having to do that yourself would be really tough, but like, that's one of the things that still to this day differentiates the iPhone from any other smartphone. You can, I just saw something on Twitter like a week ago, and guy was like, I'll switch to Android as soon as I can scroll it. And he like just shows just how nice the scrolling is and the back and forward. And it's still, you know.
And then you think about like force push or whatever, force, whatever the newer iPhones have.
3D touch or whatever.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's, that's a whole new dimension to it.
Yeah. Very interesting.
It's like Ember's router for your gestures.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true. State machine.
There are a lot of state machines in game engines.
I've heard that. And I've heard that, in some ways, like the web community is discovering them for the first time or being more upfront and explicit about them, whereas programmers in more complex environments have known that that was the approach you should take for a long time.
How does the state machine like manifest in a game? Because I always think of a game as just like open world. You can move wherever you want.
Yeah. I mean, it manifests in different lots of different places. So gesture, you know, user interaction is one. Another I've used it in is semi-autonomous behavior. So having some, imagine you've got like a character and it has a different set of animations, and it can be walking or it can be standing still or it can be jumping or running. Those are different states, and they're animations that represent the transitions between running and jumping or walking and jumping. So some artist has created all of those little sections of animation, but then you've got to tie all those together and know what state that character's in, so you can play the correct animation to get, you know, from one state to the next. Or if you've got like I did an art project where I had these little stick people that were walking around and interacting with each other in this very kind of simple world. So they would go through a life cycle from birth to death where they would be born, and then they would start looking for resources. And I had different resources around this 3D environment. And so they would find the nearest resource, walk to it. When they got to that resource, they would change state essentially and harvest.
And you had an actual state machine.
There's an actual state machine. Yes.
There's only one place one state can be in. Here are the valid transitions from one state to the next.
Yep. And it was like proximity to their target would trigger the transition from one state to the other. And so that's where when you implement stuff like that, you know, in C++ or Java, you know, pull down from your shelf the, you know, Gamma et al. What's that? Design patterns book, the classic design patterns book. And look
at
some
in there.
Yeah. Look at some of the design patterns that are like, what's the right abstraction to, have these different classes that allow me to create a state machine and these transitions in a way that's like from a coding perspective, going to be clean. It's very interesting.
Yeah. It sounds super interesting. They were talking about it like, you know, once you start doing this UI development in JavaScript world, like you're doing an autocomplete search box and then boom, that thing has like 12 states or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's way more than you think. And so most people start those kinds of things without thinking about explicit state machines. Also, because if you think about the mental model from a server rendered background, it's just
stateless.
Like, yeah.
That's the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Right. Beautiful, and that's, you know, world. Functional programming. Everything is a function and there's no state to maintain. It's all encapsulated. So yeah, those ideas come up against each other for sure. But as the people who are like do a full deep dive into functional, like they hit roadblocks. And just like us when we're choosing like what we're doing a server rendered app or we're doing SPA, it's like there's going to be, you're just exchanging one set of problems for another.
Yeah.
So it's
not easy. It doesn't become easy.
Right. Yeah. It's just like, if you can pick the right abstraction for the right, or the right approach for the right problem, then maybe it becomes a little bit easier.
Right.
Hopefully.
Right.
Did you find when you first got into Ember or JavaScript that mm-hmm. like, oh, I know, I recognize this problem because of your background here?
A little bit, but I will be honest and say that JavaScript threw me for a loop for a long time. Like, I was really hacky with it for a while because it was asynchronous in so many ways that I was not used to. And I still get on, I'm so thankful for things like Ember concurrency and like that. I understand that more in my mental model than even, you know, promises and like trying to figure out how to, I mean, if I look back at some of the early JavaScript code I wrote when I was still doing Symfony stuff and we were starting to bring some front end interactivity into those PHP based web apps, I'm sorry.
Everyone has those skeletons.
Absolutely.
Like, everyone.
Especially if you're coming, if your introduction to JavaScript was that.
Yeah.
As opposed to today, I imagine maybe somebody
like jQuery was my introduction to JavaScript.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think it takes a little while when you're learning a new language to get to a certain level of comfort with the syntax and the language. And especially if you're using a framework. Where you start to think about, oh, you remember, I'll put it this way, you remember, oh, I can create my own classes, you know?
Right.
I can create my own Pojo or my own,
right,
you know, Ruby objects to do whatever I want in order to bring some of those design patterns into right. the framework as if I were creating it from scratch. But you get into like this mindset of the framework and you're like, oh my gosh, the framework doesn't have a way to do this.
Right, right, right.
And it takes a little while to kind of like put those pieces back together, especially if you're learning a new language. So that was my experience with JavaScript.
Awesome.
I mean, that's some of the criticism of like tools, like we were talking earlier about the criticisms of Rails and stuff like that. And I still remember this like random Yehuda Katz answer on Stack Overflow about either Rails or Ember. And someone basically said this exact question, which is like, I need this particular thing. I don't see it in the Ember docs. And he was like, well, it's time to like pull up your bootstraps and like get, you know, build an object oriented little microsystem. Cause that's the best way to solve this right here. And like, that's, you know, mm-hmm. if you were to survey all of the possible patterns here, like that is how you solve it. So just go do it more
right.
or less. But it's, I feel exactly the same way. And like, I know enough Rails to be dangerous, but I don't know Ruby the way like Ryan does or Herman does, because they were doing Rails development deeply for many years.
Yep.
And so, I feel the same way about different technologies.
Yep.
But I love frameworks because,
I mean, I think
you can get so far so fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. But,
I mean, maybe that's all it is you need to kind of go through the pain of the framework,
right.
and then you there's one day where you realize like, oh, everything just extends from Ember object,
right,
and then so, oh, I can actually create my own singletons,
right,
and mm-hmm. you can build up those, you know, whatever you're talking about, that micro
right
OO design,
right,
but you got to go through that,
yep.
that pain,
yes. Yes,
yeah, I mean, I think the benefits outweigh the drawbacks for sure.
Yep.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, maybe that's an opportunity for you know, documentation, or an opportunity for training that takes you from kind of beginning to intermediate to advanced.
Right.
You know, there's not as much out there around a framework that takes you from intermediate to advanced,
yep.
which is a niche I think you guys are nicely filling.
Yep. Yep.
For Ember right now.
I mean, that's why we started Ember Map, was
yep.
for that reason.
So you asked me a minute ago, you know, why did I choose Ember Rails as part of the stack?
Right.
So a big part of it was I knew I was going to be the only one working on this for a while. And it was the thing that I'd done the last couple projects on. So it was the thing that I felt like I could be fastest with.
Right.
Also I knew I was going to be dealing with a lot of real-time data.
Yeah. And different data sources.
Yes.
That's different data sources. Like, based yes. on what you were talking about earlier.
Yes, absolutely. So that's a nice, like, there's a nice separation of concerns where the Rails backend can be a stable interface to the front end
mm-hmm.
and integrate with a variety of channels of data in the backend and bring that together.
Yep.
That's
how we...
I absolutely love that architecture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's we've done both in the past, where you have like your MRAP talking to multiple things, but it's really nice to have a choke point like that.
Mm-hmm. And I did some experimentation with, you know, like integrating with some of the APIs that I was playing with in browser land versus in the back end.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's also like batch processing we have to do.
Yeah.
There's a lot of data, you know, and so being able, like knowing that we're going to have to page through data,
cache it, maybe,
you know, stream it, you know, it's changing in real time. Like you're, for example, we've got like, you know, locations of vehicles that might be updating every 5 seconds and you're not going to, you know, refresh the entire page. So even if you did decide to, even if I had decided to do this as a server rendered app, I would have had to sprinkle a ton of JavaScript in anyway, WebSockets or, you know, little components that used, you know, AJAX requests to get the data or stuff like that. So you might as well kind of bite the bullet and know that you can load some data, get started, and then like, you know, get what you need as you go.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, we have like the main thing that we have, in terms of the Ember Rails. So there's a widget that gets embedded on a customer's website. So it's an Ember app that gets loaded in an iframe, and it presents, a map, basically a Google map, and it shows the bus routes and it shows where the vehicles are on the map.
Oh, cool.
And then you can tab over, it uses material design, like layout wise, you can tab over to the schedule and browse the schedule for that particular route.
Nice.
And then you can tab over to a trip planner. So you can say, I'm going from here and to here. And right now I just, you know, send you off to Google Maps with that request, but we log that request. And then in the back end, we can explore the data in different ways. So everyone that plans a trip in the front end, we then, you know, we take that kind of origin destination data and we can do heat maps and other types of things in the dashboard in the back end.
Nice.
Yeah. So we started with just focusing on the public transit data, and we're kind of expanding the product and the approach to all the forms of mobility data as we realize that that's really where it's the importance is to bring it all together.
Cool. Have you ever compared the real-time GPS data to like the actual schedules?
Yes.
And how does that, like, have you learned anything from that? Or
yeah. So one of the first things that we did when we were pitching for the first accelerator program we went to was I downloaded this app onto my phone that would take a GPS trace, and I rode the bus and logged that GPS data. And then I took that and wrote a little bit of JavaScript to play that back in the browser alongside the scheduled bus.
Oh, so like literally in Mario Kart when you race yourself.
Yeah. Yes. So you'd literally see like, here's where the bus is supposed to be, and here's where it actually is. And actually we did this with a trip that David took from downtown Orlando to UCF, which is on the east side of town, and takes an hour and a half on the bus to get there, even though in a car it would take you like 30 minutes.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So just dramatically showing, you know, that difference. So yes, have done that. And basically that's what the prediction engine does, is it ingests the schedule data and then it ingests that real-time data and it uses that and it compares it compares it to historical data as well to figure out when the vehicle is going to arrive at every subsequent stop that is on that trip.
That's super cool.
Yeah. So it is doing exactly that. It's comparing the real-time data to the scheduled data and historical data.
Nice.
Yeah.
The widget that you embed, that will be on a provider's page, basically.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So, for example,
one of our early adopters was the city of Sanford, which is north of Orlando. It's kind of a suburb, so to speak, of Orlando. And you go to sanfordfl.gov, and you go to the page that describes their trolley service, and you see our widget, and there's a little loading. I'm using the Ember Load. Is that what it's called?
Some add-on that helps you.
Yeah. Somebody's Mike North. I don't know. Somebody's add-on that, lets you do a little bit of CSS animation for a loading screen in the initial HTML
that's delivered before the Ember app
initializes and boots. So when you get to the page, you first see loading, little CSS animation.
So you don't see a white screen,
while,
basically.
Yes, yeah. While the Ember app is loading, and then the Ember app loads.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And we're, you know, we integrate with Mixpanel as well. So we're like collecting user interaction data and different stuff like that.
Nice. And then, so the Rails part and the Ember part is the main part.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said you were mentioning a Node server earlier.
Yes. So in between the Rails server, so let's walk from the hardware trackers that are on the vehicles up to the Rails server. So we found some essentially off-the-shelf hardware. It's like a fits in the palm of your hands, GPS chip, cellular, SIM card. You can install that on a vehicle, and that's provided by a third party.
Do you recommend the city buy those and put
if
those
they
in?
Don't have
if they don't already have it
trackers on vehicles? Yes.
Okay, so you're really like end to end, so everything from the tracking to the widget. UI.
Yep.
Yeah.
So the trackers get installed in the vehicles. That's provided by a third party that provides either an API that you can fetch data from. They also have webhooks that will push data. So I had them configure a webhook to push data into PubNub, the data streaming network. Those updates come asynchronously. So vehicle A and vehicle B might be sending GPS updates offset from each other. The first thing that we need to do is aggregate those updates, whatever the latest information is from those vehicles, into a snapshot of the whole fleet. So at any point in time, I need to essentially know where every vehicle is based on its most recent update to push into the next stage of the stack.
What's the next stage?
The next stage is the prediction engine,
which is
the Java,
written in.
It's a Java app.
So is that pulling from PubNub, or is PubNub pushing into that?
The hardware trackers push into PubNub. The Node app subscribes to the channel on PubNub. So it's a publish subscribe type architecture. And so those
also
updates get pushed into the Node app.
Yep.
The Node app maintains that state in memory, basically, of like where all the vehicles are. And then the Java app fetches that on a schedule, like every second.
So the Node app like basically can normalize everything into a hash table, regardless of when it was when it was updated. And then the Java app can request.
Yep.
Very cool.
And so trying to separate that out, instead of like writing a new adapter in the Java app to connect to the data streaming network and do that aggregation, I decided for better or for worse to create a little microservice, you know, that would just be focused on that one thing.
Yeah.
With an eye towards scalability,
right,
of the whole architecture.
Node is web scale. Non-blocking IO.
Yeah.
Web scale. It sounds like perfect tool for the job, really.
Yeah. So that runs on Heroku. And that's been working out pretty well. I've been working on...
And it doesn't write to a database or anything, just keeps the memory.
Keeps it in memory.
So that way, like, it doesn't... It's not a huge deal. I mean...
It's not a huge deal because it's like... it's not a huge deal.
Yeah.
The next logical step would be to use something like Redis, like an in-memory store that's not just the memory of the running process,
right,
in case the process dies.
Craps out, yeah.
So it can reconnect.
Yeah, I can imagine as soon as you have like, oh, we need two node processes. Mm-hmm. Then it's like, okay,
yep,
time to move that data structure around.
Exactly. Yep. But for now, it's good enough. But it's not good enough. It's not good enough for me anymore. I'm working on adding some monitoring and logging that has been a little ad hoc. And so I'm starting to look at things like Sentry for exception handling. And even like we were talking about PagerDuty earlier today, is like one thing that I want to monitor that I've been working on this week is monitoring the refresh rate and the latency from the hardware provider into the data streaming network.
Mm.
And then I want to basically, those are two like key performance indicators that I need to monitor at each level of the stack. It's like, how long has it been since this vehicle last gave me an update? And how long did it take the update to get to me from the previous step? Because really you want to minimize the latency and make sure that the refresh rate doesn't drop below like 30 seconds at the most.
I see. Because you can't just trust that you got a GPS position.
Mm-hmm.
You also need a timestamp with that to know.
Right.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, and a timestamp comes with it. So just, you know, it's pretty simple comparison, but it's like starting to put some of those things in to make the whole stack a little bit more robust. and get ahead of problems. So, because we're still, you know, we're still figuring out like where are the weak points. And ultimately, once you start providing real-time information to somebody around transit, it becomes mission critical.
Yeah.
So, and even some of the, you know, projects that we're going after, larger projects that we're going after, require SLAs, you know, so like trying to kind of take it to the next level of stability and high availability, which is cool because I've always wanted,
it's a problem.
Yeah. I've always wanted to like work on something that was a highly available system just because I think it's kind of cool and challenging. I used to read a blog called High Scalability, which would talk about like all the startups that were, you know, figuring out all these problems and stuff. And yeah, I just think it's really interesting. It does produce some problems though. It's like when something goes down, if I'm the only one that knows how to fix it, you know, that's a problem. So externalizing the stuff that's built up in my brain over the last 2 years into documentation so that when we start getting interns or employees, we can, you know, have them be part of monitoring things. So
yeah, a lot of moving parts.
Yep.
On the scalability, when like you think about that and you think about like the weak points in your system, do you see the answer there being like a custom AWS setup or do you think like services like Heroku and PubNub, like that's the answer? Like how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's both. We went after a big RFP and it was a good opportunity for me to kind of envision the next version of our architecture, that would be required for a larger size fleet and a client that wanted to do like more sophisticated data analytics. And so what I'm thinking about now is more of an AWS centric solution. And especially as we get into multiple data streams and stuff, it's like, if you've heard of the concept of a data lake before, it's basically, you know, S3, it's like put all your data in one place in a structured way so that you know where it is, how to access it, and you can do what you need to do with it. So I think of it in stages, like get the data ingested in one place, and then create little services that manipulate it based on what questions we need to answer. So it's coming at it from both ends. It's like you guys talk a lot about like building outside in and like
the needs of the
letting the needs of the front end drive the needs of the back end. So like the only difference there is like I know I'm going to need all the data,
right?
So I'm going to start ingesting the data
as much as possible. We've talked in the past too about like the log-based storage, how if you just save all the facts, you have given yourself the maximum amount of flexibility going forward.
Right. So I'm looking at things like AWS Kinesis, which enables real-time stream processing, and you can create Lambda functions.
You're getting the hairs on the back of Ryan's neck up. He's getting excited.
We've used that before, and I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, I absolutely loved it. You feel like you have superpowers.
It's so cool. Yeah it's really
cool.
Cool
down over there, Ryan.
It increases the complexity, of course.
It is super cool.
It's really cool. And it gives you flexibility too, because if you think about like a map that shows real-time information, what type of data structure or database or data storage is best suited for that? It's something that's super fast, you know, both on the reading and the writing, because you're writing into it constantly and you're also reading from it constantly.
You don't get the luxury of slow writes,
which
is, there's other solutions out there that are fast read, slow writes.
Right. So something like Redis, you know, or Amazon's hosted version of that, which is Elastic Cache, is, you know, going to be ideal for representing a fleet of 1,000 vehicles that you want to show on a map, versus if you get in, you're in the data analytics part of the dashboard and you are looking at
time series
data and aggregate information on the time series.
Yeah. Yep.
And you certainly do not want to load 3 months worth of data and process that aggregate data in the front end, right?
Yeah.
So if you're importing that into somewhere like the data lake, you can have little Lambda functions that are aggregating and processing that data over time, either in real time or as a batch process, and putting that into a relational database that has that, you know, you're essentially denormalizing your data.
Denormalizing it, yes. Materialized views.
Yep.
And Amazon has tools for all that stuff. Have you written any of those Lambda functions to do that kind of thing?
I've experimented with them. Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like, they'll stay up to date kind
and they're
of thing.
Starting, yeah, they're starting to like provide more support for other languages too. So you can actually write Lambdas in Ruby now. You don't, initially it was Java, kind of Java focused.
Java, not JavaScript.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But you can do, now you can do Node.js, you can do cool. Ruby. So they're, yeah, it's like the tooling around it, you know, it's
what you'd expect when you open up the AWS UI panel.
Yeah.
They just need to hire one UI engineer, just one. Yeah. Like, seriously. I mean, well, we found out, we always talk about like the, like, abstracting with the back end. Like the other day I was like clicking around, someone sent me this link, and if you find this button, Amazon has this like hosted GraphQL as a back end. It's called AppSync or something like that. I didn't even know it exists.
Amplify.
Yeah. AppSync.
I think it's called Amplify.
I think it's called AppSync.
Okay.
You
this
press
is,
it.
This is fine. This is just proving your point, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. You get a DynamoDB set up. You can start writing GraphQL query. It's pretty crazy, but it's like, it looks atrocious and it's like completely unusable. Well, I mean, probably super web scale, but it's like very obscure.
Yes.
And obtuse.
Yeah. So one of the things I had to do with the Java app, one of the things I chose to do with the Java app was to Dockerize it. So to figure out how to get it to run within a Docker container so that I could use Amazon, ECS, which is essentially their way of, like, you give it a Docker container, it runs on a server, but it takes care of respawning that if it fails, and it takes care of scaling if you have an architecture that supports that.
No wonder your beard got gray this last year, man.
Yeah, no wonder I can't sleep at night.
Haunted by the dreams of Docker.
How do you deploy all these things, like Docker, Node, Lambda functions? Like, how do you?
Yeah, and that story is not always really good. With Docker and ECS, it's pretty stable now. So Amazon has a Docker repository. So once you build a Docker image, it essentially becomes an artifact, and you push that artifact up into Amazon's repository. And then when you configure Amazon services to spawn that Docker image into a server and actually run, you're just giving it essentially a URL or an identifier that points to that particular image. So when you're deploying a new one, you don't even have to touch anything.
Oh, it's just
on Amazon.
Okay,
if
that's
you're
awesome.
If you're using the same tag, you know, like colon latest, like that's what I do. So I can update the image, push it to Amazon, and then the next time it respawns, you know, if I need force to respond, I could do that. But next time it responds, it uses the new image.
Cool.
Yeah.
Does it do something where, like, we have something like when we push to Heroku, they leave our old instance up, spawn
the,
a new
yeah,
instance.
So it's the blue-green deploy kind of mentality. Yeah. That is something that I haven't fully solved with this particular Java application, because it's not designed to be... It's not designed to have two instances connected to the same database.
Okay.
So the way that I'm planning on working around that is having essentially two production instances and two databases up, and then having an elastic IP address that points to one server. And so I can update the other server, and once that's running, I can switch the elastic IP address to that server. So it's a little bit, it's not really the ideal scenario because I'm dealing with a legacy open source project.
I see.
Yeah.
Cool.
And then on the Lambda functions, you know, I'm not as deep into that, but the PubNub, switch to PubNub for a second. So they can run little node functions on streaming data as well, very similar to Lambda. But I haven't fully explored their CLI, but from what I've seen, there's no way to hook into a Git post commit hook to redeploy the function. Like, you actually have to use their dashboard and paste the code in.
What could go wrong?
Yeah. So what I did, because I was working on that this week as well, is, you know, obviously source control the functions. So at least I have them somewhere that they're source controlled. And then luckily I found somebody who had created an open source mock of the different PubNub functions that lets you write Mocha tests against the function.
Oh, cool.
So I did all the development locally. I wrote a whole bunch of tests and was reasonably certain that when I put those on PubNub, that they're going to do what I want them to do.
Yeah, that's a really good, it's a really good point. Like as you start to build up these like different services, especially like different like disconnected services, how do you like, what's your development process like?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like different for each piece, but that's why something like Heroku is so nice and like, you know, want to stay with it as long as I can for as many pieces as I can, because they've really,
they're responsible for that.
They're responsible for a lot of that, like the blue green deploy, and they've given developers really nice tools for things like environment variables, mm-hmm. Where you can, you know, use .env and you use that for your local development, use Heroku local and it mimics production. Mm. You can use the command line to update those environment variables on production, whereas all that stuff on Amazon is more complicated.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So
it sounds like some of it is like one-time setup where it's not really important for you to be able to reproduce and test end-to-end locally. Like once you get that stuff wired up with Docker stuff, you don't really have to. Of course, there's always possibility for integration bugs, but
that's correct. And there's ways to, you know, there's ways to do that stuff on AWS, but it gets to the point where you kind of need somebody to be a DevOps engineer. And kind of focused on that piece of the automation. Almost anything in AWS can be exported to JSON that mm-hmm. represents like the services that are underlying it. Mm-hmm. So the tools are there. It's just not as nice. But in general, what I try to do is, typical things that a lot of folks are doing, which is, you know, making sure that I have like NVM for my node versions on my local development machine, the equivalent for Ruby and Rails, using environment variables for configuration, all the 12 factor stuff to kind of like get it in a state that's going to be more easily deployable later.
Nice. Yeah. It sounds like the architecture is kind of forcing like the best practices on you,
right?
It's a good thing.
Yeah. And I'm on a journey. Like I you know, have learned a lot, and I still have a crap ton to learn.
He said nervously. Yeah. So just maybe kind of wrap it up a little bit here. We can bring it back to Ember. Like, you know, we always joke about how like when we work on a project, you know, it's like 90% of our work is in Ember and 10% is in the back end, because if we're making like kind of a straight standard CRUD app, that's usually how it is. Although like we were talking earlier among us, like the some of the work you've been doing lately, there's been more complexity in the back end. It's actually kind of sounds related in the sense that once your back end needs go beyond something very conventional, and sometimes people do that for the wrong reasons. Like sometimes people break out of back end conventions for the wrong reasons, but sometimes you're forced to, right? Sometimes there's things that you have to do in the back end for performance reasons or just sheer data quantity reasons, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think earlier I had said something like you just have a lot of data and you can't download it all, like a lot of records, and I just saw like a little nod from you, so I'm sure you've dealt with this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, even if you're using conventions and you can get pages of data, but maybe you need to aggregate it or do a materialized view, and that's when it's like, okay, actually we can't use out of the box resources or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So what's been your breakdown in terms of all this stuff? I mean, it sounds like most of your work has been on the data side, but like you were saying, it's ultimately you have your use cases driving that, at least in the middle part. But like where is the complexity breakdown here?
Yeah, it's kind of 50-50. And I definitely would have done some things differently if I were starting the app now. Let's see, like a couple things that we could talk about. Authentication, authorization, data modeling, and let's
testing,
start there.
Maybe
testing, yes. So
sounds like a lot of the same problems a lot of us have, right?
Yeah,
modeling is always
seriously
a problem.
Yeah. So authentication, authorization. I had been wanting to try Auth0 mm-hmm. for a while, and you know, basically that's a way to, you know, this idea of like services to take care of the things that so you don't have to code them from scratch. Yeah. So as part of that, I decided that Auth0, and this is how it's designed, like that was going to be the source of truth for my users and my and the groups that the users belong to. But there's a couple bits of complexity that come with that. First, you've got like some integration to do with JSON web tokens, and they did a pretty good job of like, this is how you do this with an Ember and Rails app. And so that was not too difficult. But you have to just like, you have to decide, okay, am I going to even have a users table in my database?
Yeah.
Or am I going to completely do this through the attributes of the JSON web token that comes back once I authorize with auth zero? So I went a little bit too far towards like initially thinking, oh, I don't even need a users table. I don't even need a groups table,
right?
A membership table, all those things. Right. And I've slowly had to bring those things back in.
Because maybe your Ember app, you want to like include users.memberships and all of a sudden you can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like that stuff is not, if that stuff is not where you think it's going to be in the data, but it's in this ephemeral space of the tokens that are passed back and forth between the front end and back end, it just complicates things.
With something like that, don't you, every request has to be authenticated, right? That's what the JWT is for though. And you don't have to re-request it each time.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's an expiration expiration that comes with it. So you just have to refresh it before the expiration.
I think that the JSON web token will say something like, I'm user 123 and I've signed this. And then your backend can just verify the signature. And if the signature checks out, you know, you can just trust that they're user 123.
And you know, like in JSON API resources, they have the context method, which will essentially be a place where you could put all that stuff and get to it. But it's not really the same as
re-verifying,
as having loaded like the user in the way that you would if you had used Devise or something like that.
Do you, so like given that you're, you know, you've got everything in the service and now you kind of want it in your own database, is the next step here like write something that pulls like scrapes data from auth zero?
Yeah. And so they've got APIs so that you can do that. So the step, the even kind of somewhat hacky step before that is to use the well-known UUIDs that come from auth zero when initially creating the data in the back end, so that I know they match up with still what I'm considering the source of truth, but I can kind of build off that. I can put stuff around. So
you just duplicate it, but then you can, from the perspective of your like controllers, Rails controllers or resources, you can just use those.
Yeah. And like, it's gotten complicated where it's like, okay, I've got all these different data feeds and the data feed belongs to an account, and you know, users can have memberships into accounts, and like, so which data feeds do I return to the front end based on the user that's logged in, and where does that logic live?
Yeah.
Cause right now in the back end, it's through like, you know, has many through associations in Rails, but there's a couple jumps to get from user to feeds. From the front end's perspective, the Ember is just fetching slash feeds. Without specifying, you know, feeds,
and it's scoped down to
without
the
filtering
user.
Filtering, and this, so the scoping is kind of done in the back end without the front end knowing about it, and that becomes problematic when you get into the testing and even just the development, because it's like they're not on the same page.
We started moving more towards just replicating it, and of course the back end's going to make sure if you do
get if you try feeds, to
filter by
something.
User ID 123, let's say, then you're not user 123 currently signed in, then it's going to 404 or whatever, auth fail, not 401 or something, unauthorized.
401, yeah.
And but what would be like the canonical dumb way to do it? It would be like get feeds filter with a filter thing on user ID of one, and you're user one, so it works. And that way, like, you avoid some of the problems you're talking about. And also, if you ever happen to add an admin or any page of the front end that wants to get feed from multiple users, you're kind of screwed in a sense.
Right.
If you've gone down the path that slash feeds is always going to return scope to a single user. Because sometimes that assumption just turns out to be, it's true for some time period of time.
For sure.
But
and,
not
and
for
we
others.
And we started with that where it was like the super admin permissions, you know, I use like permissions to do some of these things too that are in the context from auth zero. So it's like if you have the read all feeds permission than you know, the back end will return
different.
All, but it that's been complicated.
Yeah.
Data modeling has been complicated, and I made, I would say one mistake I made is, so I described the GTFS data as like a relational database in CSV format. I adhered to that pretty tightly when I was initially developing the app, and it's that I wouldn't do that again. So like the foreign keys within that structure are strings. They can be strings, and they're compound foreign keys in the context of my application, because I have different versions of the app. So as soon as I started different versions of the feed. So as soon as I started bringing this concept of like, okay, I'm going to duplicate this feed from version 13 to version 14, it's all the same tables, and those IDs all stay the same. They have to stay the same when you export it into Google or something, because they need to be stable. But then you've got this concept of like the feed ID plus the route ID makes that unique row.
Whereas if you were just doing it vanilla Rails, you'd have auto incrementer and all that kind of stuff. So you're fighting that.
Yeah, so I'm fighting that. So I think what I'm going to do is bring in auto increment normal foreign keys for all of those tables and deal with that on the export side.
So that within Rails,
Within Rails,
the boundaries are
because that's messed up my relationships, my ability to do typical relationships both in Rails and in Ember, because of the messiness of that.
Yeah, and even though this is like, you know, trivial, it's still, there's like friction
when you're
dealing with
so much friction.
Yeah, and you're just you're framework fighting.
Yes.
And
yeah,
even though it's possible to do and do it, it's just one of those things where it's like, just want to be on the happy path.
So it's on my list, but I know it's going to be a heavy lift.
Isn't it funny though, like it just reminds me of like when I first was learning, you know, I learned a lot of the domain modeling stuff through Symfony and then Rails. How amazing it is though, open source, like just surfacing, like we just know how to store relational data now, and like you should, there's no good reason not to do it the way all these tools do it. Like basically there's no good reason to use natural keys or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like there's a reason why Laravel, Rails, Symfony all use auto incrementing IDs, all these kinds of things, you know.
Yeah. From like a data purist perspective, you know, you can think about like what's the most correct way to represent it.
Right.
But that's not the right question to ask when you're, you know, creating something that's a functional, you know, application.
In the real world. Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Interesting.
Yeah.
So JSON API resources on the back end.
Yes. So Sam, you and I talked about that a little bit earlier. It's like I picked it because it was the most, it seemed like the right thing to pick 2 years ago.
Right.
Two or 3 years ago. And since then, you know, the kind of development on it has rapidly fallen off.
Yeah.
And the interest and focus has shifted to GraphQL.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you're gonna lose those guesses sometimes.
Yeah.
And so that's been somewhat painful because things like you know, operations and batch
bulk processing
right, have not, the story on that has not improved over time.
Yeah. We were just talking about this last week. It would be nice to have known, like, this is not anyone's to blame, but it just bring it back to last week's conversation. It's like, if you would have known a year ago, like, hey, this is not going to be worked on, it would have been better to know that a year ago and just heard a no clear, you know.
Yep.
We can't always do that, but sometimes we can, so I think it's a good thing, it's a good muscle to flex when we know, you know. And we're trying to do that, you know. We just gave up an add-on recently because we wanted to work on it, but it was like, you look around, it's like you haven't worked on it in 2 years. It's like, that's really crappy. There's like PRs that have been open for a long time. It's really not a good feeling. So and it's not helpful.
It's like having a piece of clothing in your wardrobe that you haven't touched in 2 years and got to Marie Kondo that shit.
Seriously, just get rid of it. Just slam it down in the trash. Goodwill bag. That's kind of an interesting kind of thread.
But yeah. I mean, I would say, the one thing I would say is like, I'd way rather use JSON API resources and JSON API as a structured format for a REST, RESTful style API than just design my own RESTful style right. API.
Right.
So that was a big step up from just kind of arbitrarily, yep. you know, picking your routes and trying to follow some, like, it's good to have that structure.
Absolutely. And like, yeah. we really want to explore GraphQL. We have, but we want to do it more seriously. But all the lessons we've learned from JSON API, we're going to bring with us no mm-hmm. matter what we do next. And we know that GraphQL is even lower level semantic. It doesn't have the same semantics as JSON API. Not even close. It's very low level.
Yeah.
But layering the semantics of JSON API on top would be basically what, if I was going to use it tomorrow, that's basically what I would do, because I know the problems JSON API solves mm-hmm. and I know I'm going to run into those, and I just want to have a pointer to a resource be all that stuff. So
yeah.
The semantics of JSON API are not
a problem.
They don't cause problems for us. It's
right.
it's a the tooling problem. It's right. a support problem type right. thing. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Figuring out the escape hatches has been challenging too. I've struggled a little bit with filtering sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because like when you can create on the Rails side, you can create a little Lambda that does a custom, you know, filtering, if you've got to pull in other things, but you don't have the full context of all of the, like, at least I haven't figured out a way to have the full context of all the filters that were passed in the request at that point in the processing stack.
So, you know how you have like that context where you can put the current user?
Yeah.
You can also shove params.
Oh there. Yeah.
And I do that, and I just feel so, so dirty
yeah.
when I have access.
But man, no, that's a good tip, because I'm like, I really could use the, you know, the feed ID here when I'm pulling something about the route ID in this particular filter. And, you know, an argument could be made that that's showing some other weaknesses of the data modeling or something like that. But
absolutely.
Yeah. But like at the end of the day, it's like, can I make it work or can I not make
yeah.
it work?
Yeah. You know what? That's so funny. For some reason, reminds me of like 6 years ago working with this guy who was, I was showing him Ember, and like, you know how the actions on Ember, just get the argument from the template. They don't get the event. And like now they're going to get the event, I think, right? In like Octane and stuff, but they wouldn't. And so you would click on it, and you'd want to like, they would want to have the model be the first parameter. Like if you're trying to access like if you're typing in an input field and you're a web developer and you've never used Ember before and you want, like, how do I get e.target.value? Because that's the value in the thing. It's like, no, you need to understand how Ember does it. Mm-hmm. You need to bind the name to a field on like a model and bind the model to the input. Because if you were to just grab e.target.value and not set up the binding correctly, something else could change the name of this and the input wouldn't reflect it. So that's like true.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's very hard to anticipate all the problems in the problem space that you've taken on. So it actually ends up being frustrating. Like, you do want those, it's a hard balance to strike. You do want to nudge them, but there's a sign of humility to be able to say, here's the full escape hatch.
Yes.
And I think DHH has put it in a way that I like, where he's like, this is for people who are willing to learn how to use it, and we're not going to treat you like a child or whatever. I'm not saying anyone's treating us like children. It's more just like, we're not going to treat you like you're a child and you can't decide on your own. So here are like, here's how everything works. But for you to really get the value out of Rails, you need to learn how to do it. And I think there's an argument for designing libraries and open source projects like that, where it's like mm-hmm. just knowing when you go into it, you're not going to solve the entire problem space. So you need to consider, okay, what is the raw thing here? Because
yes.
otherwise people are going to get frustrated and stuck.
Yes, the 80-20 rule.
Yeah.
You're gonna solve like 80% of the problems, but then the other 20%, if you don't give people a way around it, if you don't at least make it possible,
yes,
then that's going to be a headache for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's like one of the big things I feel like I've learned in open source. And like with Storefront, we like just let you pass through options to Ember data, even if we would want to like encapsulate that, because we know we haven't thought of everything. So
yep.
Yeah.
I experienced that with, go ahead, Ryan.
No, go.
I experienced that with a Google Maps Ember add-on that was a little too like tightly
yep.
tied to replicating the Google Maps API into the Ember add-on. And then I recently upgraded to a new one that was more hands-off with that.
Yeah.
It was like, here's the object that gets created from the Google Maps API so that you can do whatever you need to or
right.
want to with it.
Right.
Here's like a very thin layer over that
Sugar.
That's Ember-ish.
Right.
And that's a much better balance.
Right.
That's such a good point. That aligns so, so nicely with your input story, where it's like the same thing, where it's like we're trying to sugar over the perfect solution.
Right.
But yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have noticed this with add-ons. I think a couple of years ago, every add-on was trying to say, okay, how do I make a service? How do I make a bunch of nested components to represent this? And then now I feel when I see newer add-ons, it's how do I get you as close to the real library as possible?
Yeah. And what you guys have been saying about like renderless components mm-hmm. and, you know, more often than not, it might be the case where the add-on doesn't need to do anything besides be that thin of a layer between.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is also too, like auto import, I think has improved this story a lot too,
totally.
Because mm-hmm. you don't, a lot of times you don't need an Ember add-on anymore. And it turns out you didn't even though like an Ember add-on could be like the ideal solution.
Mm-hmm.
Auto import gets your problem solved today. So
yeah. Some things that I love about Ember, cause I was working on some projects, a couple years ago that were like Node, Express, MongoDB, and some just vanilla JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like really unstructured,
right?
Really open space. The opposite of
too much sugar.
Yeah. So I really, you know, the thing that drew me to Symfony mm-hmm. When I was doing PHP work is the same thing that drew me to Rails, that drew me to Ember, is having those convention over configuration and like the, as long as you're willing to be humble and like let go of your ways of doing things and kind of follow the happy path, it can be really nice to develop in. Also the stability, like the focus on backwards compatibility, on RFCs and like making thoughtful decisions about breaking changes, you know, that stuff comes into play once you're talking about production, long-lived production apps and like supporting stuff. Like I mean,
2 year production apps. It doesn't have to be that long lived.
Long-lived, yeah. Right. Long-lived in web development timeline is it's just crazy, but it's like, do you want to be spending all your time like updating to a brand new API, or do you want to at least know that like the fact it's so mature for the community to have LTS releases for a JavaScript framework?
Yeah.
Like learn from people who have been, you know, doing Linux distributions and other things that people depend on and mm-hmm. taking those best practices is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, it's not to be underestimated, the value of that.
Yeah. And it's
very cool.
It's true. It's not just like mm-hmm. some blanket statement. It's actually true. I had to update our CMS, Ember Map CMS, mm-hmm. Last week. And I was freaking out because how old is it? It's like 2.5 years old.
Something like
2 years
it's like
old.
It's like a demo app we use for videos.
Okay.
No. This was our actual CMS.
Ember Map CMS.
Yes.
Okay.
Not Ember Map CMS. Ember Maps CMS.
Yes. We also have another project called Ember Map CMS, which is a demo thing. This is our actual CMS.
That we use to publish videos every week.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a few bugs, and it's this, I mean, this thing is just riddled with tech debt. It's old and I have to upgrade it. And I've just been putting it off because I know that I'm going to hit some like NPM error and just be stuck upgrading it.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled down the GitHub repo, ran, it doesn't even use Yarn. Yarn wasn't out when we made this thing.
Yeah, yeah. Mine doesn't use Yarn.
So I ran NPM install mm-hmm. and Ember test and everything built and passed.
Wow.
And I was shocked.
Yeah.
But yeah, the stability story is, it's real.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yep. Yeah. That's cool. And then I know some things that you've said, which other folks have said too, you know, hiring is hard or getting help with Ember specific stuff is difficult.
Yeah. As I think ahead, you know, trying to build a startup company and recruiting, you know, if we get big new projects, they're probably going to be React on the front end, not Ember, because it's going to be easier to find people to work on them.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's, you know, I would love to stick with Ember for stuff, but I've talked to other founders, especially in Orlando, that have had trouble, you know, kind of filling those roles and finding Ember developers. And I mean, we're hoping to build a primarily remote, like a remote first type mm-hmm. company. So that does broaden the scope, mm-hmm. you know, to folks who can be anywhere in the world, working on Ember projects, but it's something to consider.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely something. It's a important factor when you're thinking about like building a bigger engineering team.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It's good to talk about that. And yeah, if the community is over indexing on the stuff that makes Ember great, and that mm-hmm. stuff does make Ember great, but If there's things that are deal breakers, it's important for everyone to understand those things too.
Yeah.
Maybe reallocate resources, or if people are looking to get involved and care about the success and longevity of Ember.
Yeah, because part of the longevity is having people use it.
Yeah.
And having people use it for real world projects.
Yes.
For sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, I've benefited so much from what you guys have put out over the last, you know, while since you started EmberMap. It's really, the content's great. I've been stuck many times and found like either Googled something and it's led back to EmberMap, or it's led back to like one of y'all's posts on GitHub on some thread.
Yeah.
That's like the exact problem that I'm having.
Nice.
So that's been fun because it makes me feel, you know, connected to you.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. You guys are good teachers and good at kind of thinking through the meta questions of what people are dealing with within this ecosystem.
That's where 3 hours of every Monday goes, the meta questions. Cool, man. Well, yeah, we're just trying to pay back for you getting me into programming, you know?
Yeah. So. It was inevitable.
Yeah, that's true. We joke sometimes because, like, people meet us now and, like, our family, and it's like, oh yeah, dad's a software engineer, my brother's a software engineer, and I mean, we're all many things, but you know, I'm a software engineer now, and it's like, oh, that must have been, actually, like, no, it wasn't always true. Like, Nathan was doing art, dad was a music teacher, I was studying economics, and mm-hmm. It's just like, couldn't avoid your fate, I guess. So
yeah,
technology is just too powerful. You know, people who want to make an impact, it's one of the best ways to do it.
Right, it's like a superpower when you pair it with something else. Really, is yep. I think what it comes down to. So, and I think when you're an interdisciplinary person,
right,
it makes it more relevant to have the coding experience. So, like the fact that we have also been into music and art and economics and other things, like, gives us a unique perspective on the role that technology plays, I think.
Very cool. Well, hey, I think that's a great place to end it. Thanks so much for your time coming by today. It's awesome, man.
Super.
Cool to see how Ember is being used also. Like, I think the problem you're solving is really interesting. I think there's probably actually a lot of people in the audience who'd be pretty interested in keeping up with what y'all are doing. So where should they go to just keep in touch with you and find how Omnimodal is going?
Yeah, so you can find Omnimodal at omnimodal.io. So omnimodal.io. At Omnimodal on all the social media stuff. And I'm at N Selikoff, which you already know how to spell Selikoff because of Sam. So at N Selikoff on social media and GitHub and all those things. So
awesome.
Yeah, would love to connect with folks who are interested in Ember and transit data, and that space is fun to play with. So
very cool.
Please do reach
Super
out.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks again. Thanks, you,
guys.
Everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next week.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.